I want to really thank everybody for being here today at the Ohio Inaugural Conference. This has really been a long time coming and a long time planning. My name is Jedediah Bressman, and I'm the president of the Ohio State Moritz College of Law's Federalist Society. It's an honor to be here today to introduce the keynote speaker, J.D. Vance, but I'd like to take a moment to kind of brag about your local student chapter. Each year, the Federalist Society grants the James Madison Chapter of the Year Award to one student chapter out of the more 200 chapters that exist around the country. This year, the Moritz Federalist Society won the Chapter of the Year Award. Not only is it impressive to win this award, but of who we beat. University of Chicago was also nominated. Harvard, Penn, Texas, Virginia, and Yale all were nominated for this award. The criteria includes, among other things, how many people attended the events over the year, the difference in topics, and national membership. After hosting 14 events this year, we averaged over 100 students, faculty, and staff, and had a record of 250 attendees at our Supreme Court preview event. The Moritz College of Law's administration, the Columbus Lawyers Chapter, and our advisor, Professor Chris Walker, we were able to not only achieve this, but also do many events with our Columbus Lawyers Chapter. I'd also like to take a quick moment to thank my other executive board members, Vice President Jay Payne, Secretary Tara Workman, Treasurer Andrew Hopkins, and co-marketing chairs Tom Lantman and Amanda Morris. Without these great people around me, none of our events or this event would be possible. So I'd like to thank my executive board members and thank all of you for being here today and giving me the honor to get to present this award today, and how cool it is to be able to hang this in our law school for the rest of its existence. Now to the main event. J.D. Vance is an investor, commentator, and author of the number one New York Times best-selling Hillbilly Elegy. Raised by his working-class grandparents in Middletown, Ohio, J.D. graduated from Middletown High School in 2003, and then immediately enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. During his time in the Marines, he deployed to Iraq in support of the Operation Iraqi Freedom. When he finished his four-year enlistment, J.D. moved back to Ohio and enrolled in the Ohio State University, where he studied political science and philosophy and helped coordinate the university's bipartisan voter education drive in 2008. After graduating from college, he studied at Yale Law School. After a stint at a large corporate law firm, J.D. moved to San Francisco to work in the technology industry. He serves as a president at the leading Silicon Valley venture capital firm, Mithril Capital, co-founded by Peter Thiel and A.J. Rowan. As an investor, J.D. has taken special interest in the biotechnology industry and other transformative sectors of the economy. J.D. continues to lecture and write on topics of public interest. In early 2007, he returned home to Ohio to found Our Ohio Renewal, a nonprofit organization dedicated to addressing the state's opioid crisis and bringing high-quality employment and educational opportunities to Ohioans. He regularly discusses politics and public policy on national networks and has appeared on ABC, CBS, and Fox News. He currently serves as a contributor on CNN, and J.D. lives right here in Columbus, Ohio with his wife and two dogs, where he works on his nonprofit and investment activities. Now introducing J.D. Vance.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for having me. Thank you for that very kind introduction, and congratulations to the Ohio State Federalist Society for being Chapter of the Year. Go Bucks, right? I think that I will start a little bit by talking just about the book and about why I'm here and why I wrote the book, but I also want to pay a little bit of attention to something that Ben Flowers, who invited me to be here, he said maybe you could talk a little bit about why limited government themes didn't necessarily work in the 2016 election. And so, After I give a little bit of background, I will talk about that too. So for those of you who haven't read the book, it is primarily a personal book. I rely on sociological evidence, I rely on economic evidence, but I primarily make a personal argument with real people because I think that to understand the complexity of the problems that I write about, you really have to understand that they are incredibly complex people. They are courageous and loving and hardworking, but they also struggle in a lot of very real and very material ways. And I thought that to make their struggles seem as real as they are, to make them come to life, I had to write a book about those people, not just about the abstract ideas, but about my grandparents and my parents and ultimately myself. Now, the book was a little weird for me to write. I was 31 years old when it came out. I'm 32 years old now. So opening yourself up in a very personal way as a 31-year-old in the form of a memoir is pretty bizarre. And I didn't totally take to it. It took me a lot of time to get comfortable with writing about some of these personal stories, some of these family stories, and so forth. But I hope that a reader of the book will take away just how truly complex and significant some of the problems that are facing America's working class are. Now, we should all have in the background this understanding that when we talk about the American dream, very often what we're talking about is the odds that a poor child or a working class child, even a middle class child, can achieve his or her fair share of the American dream through the sheer determination, effort, and hard work. Now, economists typically measure that by looking at upward mobility. They look at somebody on the bottom of the income ladder and they say, what are the odds that person can rise to the top quintile, the top 20%? What are the odds that a kid born at any given moment in time will earn more than his parents, his or her parents? And the idea is pretty simple, that if we're trying to look at economic opportunity, it's not totally easy to really put an economic metric on it, but asking ourselves whether a kid who grows up in a certain circumstance is living a better life than his or her parents, or is living in a higher quintile or higher economic bracket than his or her parents, is at least a decent way to measure it. And what we know is that kids in the United States are not doing as nearly as well as many of us in this room would like. Now, I understand that, of course, we're at the Federalist Society and we are a group of conservatives and libertarians. I am a conservative myself. But I think this question about whether poor children, whether kids who are born at the bottom have much in the way of opportunity, strikes at something that is very core, not just at the identity of us as Americans, but of us as conservatives. We are not the sort of people who go around and saying everything needs to be perfectly equal, but we are the sort of people who say that we need to have equal opportunity in this country, that no matter where you were born, no matter who your parents were, you have the same chance to get ahead as everybody else. But if the statistics are what they are, then they suggest that something about that story isn't totally perfect. Something about that story isn't totally mapping onto reality. And importantly, this is a regional phenomenon. It is not the case that upward mobility is low, that the American dream is struggling in every single part of the country. If you look at San Francisco, where I lived until recently, if you look at Kansas, if you look at Utah especially, children born on the bottom in those places, even children born in the middle, are very likely to claim their fair share of the American dream. But kids born right here in Columbus, kids born in southwestern Ohio, where I grew up, kids born in Appalachia in the southeast, frankly, kids born in the places where Republicans do best, electorally, at least at the federal level, are the places where children who are born on the bottom aren't doing quite as well. Now, there are a few reasons that's happening. In fact, there are, I think, many, many reasons that's happening. One of the big problems is if you look at data by the economist Raj Chetty from Stanford, an excellent economist, there are two really significant drivers of the regional difference in upward mobility. One of them is the prevalence of concentrated poverty. And what I mean by that is it's one thing to be poor, it's another thing to grow up in a neighborhood where every single other person in that neighborhood is poor. It warps the expectations you have for your own life. It warps what you think is possible. It warps the sort of social capital and social networks that you have access to. That's a significant driver. And I want to talk a little bit about why I think conservative policy is a pretty good answer to that particular problem. But the second issue, I think something that would confirm a lot of the biases of the people in this room, is that another gigantic driver of this regional disparity in upward mobility is the prevalence of single-parent families in a given community area. And of course, it's not that surprising or counterintuitive to understand why. Children born to single-parent families, children born to incredibly unstable families are more likely to do drugs, more likely to abuse alcohol, less likely to graduate from high school, and so forth. And I think that when you take the sort of totality of what's going on, if you drill down into the details a little bit, which is what I try to do in my book, then you see a few things are happening in these areas, a few different things are happening in these communities. The first is that you see a real decline in what I call the mediating institutions, what a lot of sociologists would call the mediating institutions. I think in public policy circles, we very often get too caught up talking about the government at one end and the individual at the other end. But of course, there are so many things in the middle that play a really important role. The church, community organizations, Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you look at the data, those institutions seem to be declining in the communities that need it most. Now, we often associate, of course, the places where I grew up as the Bible Belt. And if a pollster calls people and asks them, how likely are you to go to church? Do you attend church frequently or infrequently? Are you religious? Are you an evangelical Christian? The answers to these questions almost uniformly indicate that the people living in those areas are very religious. They take their faith very seriously. But if you look at whether they're actively participating in a local community religious institution, if you look, in other words, at whether they're going to church, the data suggests that they're not, that increasingly church participation and church attendance is something that middle-income and upper-middle-income Americans do. It's not something that working and lower-income Americans do, working class and lower-income Americans do. There is, of course, a very significant problem of childhood trauma and childhood instability. I think that's getting at the macro point about the prevalence of single-parent families. Now, we know that in families like mine, in working class families, childhood trauma and instability are much more prevalent. And we know, importantly, we're increasingly learning that childhood trauma is not just bad because it puts kids in a terrible situation, maybe it exposes them to yelling and fighting and addiction in their own homes. We know that it's really bad because it actually starts to warp the way that they approach conflict and conflict resolution in their own families. We know that children who see childhood trauma in their own youth are more likely to yell and scream at their own partner, to hit their own children, to abuse drugs and alcohol when they start families of their own. And so this problem of family instability is not just a problem in the moment, it is in some ways a very terrible, very destructive seed that's planted in the minds of these kids well before they had any choice about the circumstances they were born into. Of course, another significant driver of what's going on in these low upward mobility regions is the fact that addiction is really taking root in some of these communities. Now, we all live in Ohio, so I'm sure I don't have to tell you that the opioid addiction is arguably the worst public health crisis that has existed in this country for 30 or 40 years. Last year, more people died of opioid overdose deaths than died from AIDS at the height of the HIV epidemic. That's a striking statistic, and the evidence is that it will only get worse this year. Now, of course, that's bad because you have people who are struggling with addiction. You have children who see their parents struggle with addiction. You have families who are completely thrown into chaos because of this terrible drug. But like family trauma, the addiction also plants seeds that bear very terrible fruit later on. So we know that the children who grow up in these homes are more likely to abuse drugs themselves. Importantly, we know that the grandparents and the aunts and uncles who take care of these children, they take care of them, of course, because they love them, but they're very often plunged into poverty themselves because they were planning on their retirement or their Social Security income covering one person or two people, and now they have four mouths to feed. It's one of the biggest drivers of elderly poverty in this state, is the fact that you have a ton of grandparents taking care of children because the opioid epidemic has left those children effectively orphaned. You take all of these things combined, and you get something that I think that we're not very good at talking about in American culture, and I think that we're not very good at talking about on the right, and it's a problem of culture. Now, typically, when we talk about culture in the context of the problems of low-income Americans, we say it in the sense of, look at that culture, it's defective, there's something wrong, and it ends a conversation about poverty and inequality and upward mobility that should just be beginning. And what I hope somebody who picks up my book and reads will take away is that when I talk about culture, I don't mean that the people who grow up in the families like I do are somehow fundamentally morally deficient. What I mean is something much more intuitive, and I think something that's much more true, which is that when you grow up in an environment like I do, when you don't have a lot of money, when you see addiction, when you see family trauma, when you see family dissolution, when all of that combines into this sense of hopelessness and despair, and oh, by the way, on top of it, all the factory jobs in your community are shutting their doors and laying off workers, it creates a certain sense of expectation. It breeds a hopelessness. It breeds a sense that even if you do work hard, you're not going to be able to get ahead, because how would you? You don't see anybody else getting ahead. You don't see anybody else doing especially well. And so you think that success and you think that happiness are things that are excluded from people like you. They belong to those other people, but they don't belong to me and my family. That cultural problem is one of the biggest drivers of what's going on in these communities right now. And I think we have to talk about it. And I think, importantly, we have to talk about it not in a way that's morally condemnatory, that looks at the poor and asks, why are these people making irrational, terrible, morally deficient choices, but that looks at them and says, man, there's a lot going on in their communities. There's a lot that these kids are struggling with. So I'm going to bring this back before stopping talking about the question of why limited government themes didn't necessarily do well in the 2016 election. Unless you think that limited government themes did do well in the 2016 election, I'm going to argue that they did not. So I remember in April of 2015, I was advising a couple of different presidential campaigns on domestic policy, a couple of the campaigns that were very well funded and that everybody thought might eventually produce a Republican nominee and eventually a Republican president. And I was at a gathering in Virginia of sort of Republican domestic policy wonks. And we were all sitting around the table talking about the child tax credit and tax reform and health savings accounts and entitlement reform and all these things that conservative policy wonks like to think about and like to talk about. And eventually somebody piped up, a person that I won't reveal his name now, but I guarantee that most of the people in this room would recognize his name. And he said, you guys have no idea what you're talking about. If you look at the polling, 53% of Republican primary voters in this cycle want higher taxes on the wealthy. Not lower taxes, not the same tax rate, they want higher taxes on the wealthy. And we're talking as if our base agreed with us ideologically on every single issue, when the evidence suggests that they don't agree with us on a lot of the issues that we seem to really care about. And then he said something that in hindsight makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, because it's almost prophetic. He said, somebody will take advantage of the fact that there is a populist fervor in our own policy and our own best candidates are too stupid to see it. And of course, that's what happened. Donald Trump came along and slaughtered a lot of Republican sacred cows. Some of them, I think, needed to be slaughtered. He talked about trade. He talked about immigration in a much more robust and aggressive way. But he also talked about closing the tax loophole on hedge fund carried interest. He talked about how Americans needed to have universal health care. It's kind of striking, if you think about where the party conversation was in 2012 and even 2014, that a candidate promising all those things earned such a large share of the vote. And of course, he took a lot of Barack Obama's voters from 2012 in the Rust Belt, in the industrial Midwest, and those voters made him the President of the United States. Now, I don't want to get into a, is Trump right or is Trump wrong on a lot of these issues, because I think sometimes he's right and sometimes he's wrong. What I do want to say is that if you think about the problems that I write about in the book, you think about the people who are suffering from them, and it's not just people at the very bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. A work again by economist Raj Chetty found that 60% of Americans born in the 1980s should expect to have a lower income than their parents did. First time that's been true in recent history, that a majority of Americans should expect to live a less prosperous economic life than their parents did. So this is not just a problem for the incredibly impoverished. It's not just a problem for those on the bottom. It is increasingly a problem for a little over half of American society. Now, there's work by this incredible photojournalist, Chris Arnaud, where he goes around, and you guys, if you're active on Twitter, you may have seen some of his work, but he goes around and photographs communities that are really struggling. And he was one of the first to really realize that a lot of voters who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 were going to vote for Donald Trump in 2016. There's one woman in particular he talked to that just is seared in my memory. She'd voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012. Her community was ravaged by addiction. She lives not too far from here. And she said something that almost brings me to tears when I think about it. She said, when this stuff moves in, meaning heroin, there's no place for the children to play. Meaning even the playgrounds become dens of addiction and drug use, violence, and the like. Just think about that and the fact that that woman voted for Donald Trump and ask yourself, do the limited government themes that the Republican Party and conservatives in general have been talking about apply to that woman? Do they appeal to that woman? I think any of us who's being honest with ourselves would say absolutely not. That the way that Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, as much as I admire those guys, when they stand up and talk about these issues, they're not talking about that woman's issues. They're saying nothing that really appeals to the grandma who's taking care of two grandchildren because her own daughter died of a heroin overdose. They're not really saying anything to the factory worker who really wants to get a job but can't find one because all the factories have gone overseas or closed their doors altogether. Now, does that mean that we should abandon our principles? I don't think so, absolutely not. But does it mean that we have to be incredibly thoughtful about how those principles apply to 21st century problems? Absolutely yes. Do we have to be more thoughtful about whether conservative ideas can actually help people, conservative ideas at the federal level and the state level and the local level, and of course, at the community level? Because as I argue in the book, these problems are not all the creation and they can't all be the solution of government. And I think the answer, if we're being honest with ourselves, is no, and it continues to be no. We continue to not say things that are appealing to the broad middle of the country, a middle of the country that feels rightfully so that it is not doing especially well, whether it's not doing well in being able to find a job or it's not doing well in the fact that their children are dying of heroin overdoses. Now, again, that does not mean we should be abandoning our principles. But we've got to be incredibly thoughtful about how those principles apply to these very real problems in a very large segment of our society and a very large segment of our community. Because if we don't, we're going to continue to find ourselves oscillating between two political poles, neither of which I think really cares about limited government or really cares about active communities. Now, the last point I'll leave you with is that a couple of weeks ago, Bernie Sanders did a town hall, I believe in McDowell County, West Virginia. And a lot of the people at that town hall were Donald Trump voters. McDowell County went for Donald Trump, I believe, about 81 to 19. So as big of a margin as possible in our politics. And there were a lot of people listening to Bernie Sanders who voted for Donald Trump who were nodding their head and saying, yep, that makes a lot of sense. And the point here is that when limited government folks leave a vacuum, somebody will fill it. When limited government folks talk about issues in a way that no one in the middle, no one who's really struggling, hears them and says, this person has a plan for my life, then you shouldn't be surprised when those folks don't vote for limited government conservatives and don't think that limited government conservatives really care about them or the issues that motivate their lives. And I think we have a choice. We have a choice to either do the things that are necessary, to do the hard work of thinking, to come up with policies and ideas and ways of talking about these issues that actually appeal to the struggling middle, or we can just keep on going down the path that we've gone down, the path where every couple of years, a really smart guy stands in a room of conservative policy wonks and says, hey guys, by the way, nobody is understanding what our core electorate, what our core demographic actually wants or cares about. That's not a world that I want, because I actually think that we do have a lot of good ideas. I think that our principles applied to 21st century problems can do a lot of good. And I'm mindful, of course, that I'm in a room of very elite thinkers and policy folks, the leaders in our community, who are going to determine whether those ideas are alive and relevant in the 21st century or not. And I very much hope that you decide to make them relevant and not to choose the path where people like that woman who's concerned about playgrounds not being able or not supporting play, where that woman says, those people don't have anything for me. So I encourage you to do that, and I'm glad that you guys had me here, and I appreciate being here and spending some time with you. I'll be honest. Certainly I've thought about it. Do I think that it's something that I'm interested in doing in any short-term time frame? No, because I don't think that these problems are totally addressable by government. The nonprofit that I founded is in some ways motivated by the idea that community organizations and folks living in these communities and living on the ground have to try to solve them, not just through better policy, but hopefully by, you know, other things as well. So, you know, never say never, but is it something I'm thinking about doing right now? No.
Thank you very much. I was very much struck by a lot of what you were saying, and it reminded me a lot of Burkean conservatism,
sure.
The intermediary institutions, the little platoons, the things that have definitely gone away because they were the things that people interacted with more than government. And one of the great challenges that I have seen is if you want to shrink the size of government, which I think we all do, I work at the Buckeye Institute, so we're all about trying to do that, but as you say, there's a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And something will fill that vacuum, and it always has worried me because how do we move in that direction? How do we revive all of these atrophying institutions from the Rotary Club to the churches? We have all this social media and stuff now that distracts people, and people sort of hang out in their own little enclaves online, and they don't necessarily meet people face-to-face and do the service projects. I mean, I was just with my three kids last night doing a Cub Scout clean up your school thing. That's good. That's the kind of intermediary institution that helps people inculcate the right values. But really, we have gone a long ways away from that. And I guess, how do you see that enveloping? Is it just an education process over a long period of time? And is there a role for government in trying to revive some of those as part of an effort to then cut itself back over time?
Yeah, so it's definitely an education process, a process of talking about it, and a process, frankly, of folks who are community leaders being a little bit mindful of the fact that these community institutions are really important and thinking in their own lives about how to reinvigorate them. You know, the answer, of course, is or at least part of the question is, where do we see policy playing a role here? Because I do think that you can make a credible argument that bad government policy eroded a lot of these mediating institutions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the withdrawal of government will mean these things will just spring up out of nowhere, right? In some ways, the roots aren't especially strong and they need a little bit of help. And that's a tough question. I'm not going to stand here and pretend that I know all the answers, but I do think that, you know, a very thoughtful approach to how do we reinvigorate some of these institutions will potentially produce fruitful results. And I'll think of, you know, one example where I'm very interested in this topic right now. So, you know, I'm sort of a classic free market economist type thinker. And so I don't necessarily love labor unions, especially sort of classic union shops where you have to join. But as Burke himself recognized, the labor union is an incredibly important mediating institution. And there's a lot of good evidence, separate the economic and the material productivity arguments, there's a lot of good evidence that folks who participate in labor unions are less likely to divorce, are more likely to get help when they fall into addiction, are less likely to start abusing alcohol or drugs in the first place. And so I think there's an interesting question for those of us on the right to say, how do we reinvigorate labor unions, but in a way where they serve something more like their traditional purpose and not just basically creating an incredibly zero-sum game that sets every worker against every company that they work for? And so you may know, Greg, I know you work at the Buckeye Institute, so you know, the work of Orrin Cass is really fascinating on this because his argument is that modern American labor law has effectively created a zero-sum world where every single thing, because there are such high floors and what you're allowed to do in a business, every single thing that a union gets from the business is necessarily a zero-sum trade, right? The business has to give up something for the union to get something and vice versa. So these institutions don't really work as well together. But you can imagine a situation, for example, where a union can say, well, maybe we could bargain a little bit away from the minimum wage for a 17, 18, 19-year-old worker, but then get higher wages for some of our older workers. And the evidence suggests that the minimum wage, of course, pushes younger people out of the workforce and encourages older people into the workforce. So maybe that's a way to allow, you know, maybe you can free up the way that unions interact with businesses so that you can actually create less of a zero-sum game where unions can give a little but also get a little. It may reinvigorate the union and it may actually be good for business in the long run too. So I think thinking along those lines really creatively about how do we reinvigorate some of these places is ultimately the path that a lot of us have to go in the domestic policy arena.
I really enjoyed your book, and thanks for coming out and talking. And I appreciate how difficult that book would have been to write. So, again, thank you. My question for you is, you said earlier that speaking to a group of limited government types, that maybe we need to think more broadly about what it takes to build social capital and cultural capital and build up those kind of secondary associations. My question for you is the inverse, right? Assuming we do that, assuming we reach out and we spend more time thinking about building cultural capital, what does that do conversely for some of our limited government goals? And how can we think about that process of coming back around?
Well, thank you for the kind words, first of all. And I think that's a very good question. And we have to think that, look, at every level and gradation of wealth and privilege that a society reaches, people expect certain things. It is, I think, not necessarily the best thing. We can sort of criticize whether it should be the case, but you look in every advanced economy and people expect certain things. And if somebody isn't providing those things, whether it's their family, the institutions in their community, then they expect government to provide it for them. So I think reinvigorating some of these community institutions, allowing, for example, unions to play a more active role in some of these business negotiations, but again, in a way that's actually helpful to the business and labor relationship, that means somebody's filling a gap that the government doesn't necessarily have to fill, right? If the state government is doing something, then that means that's something the federal government doesn't have to do. If a local community institution is doing something, that's something that the state government, the federal government doesn't have to do. So I do think that if the concern is limited government, and I think, you know, my view has never been that limited government as such is always and everywhere the best thing. It's that limited government just very often leads to human flourishing. So it's not the end so much as the means. But if you are worried about it as an end or as a means, invigorating some of these community institutions is the best way to enable people to want less government in their lives, right? Because that woman who's worried about her playground not being a place where her children can play, she wants answers, and she's going to find them. And the democratic process allows her to find it in government, even if some of us may not like the answer she ultimately comes to. So we've got to come up with better answers as opposed to just saying you're asking the wrong questions.
Thank you so very much. On the line of invigorating local communities, from all the sociological research that I have read, the one demographic element of society that is most weakened and has the most effect on prosperity and on a sense of hope is the working man, the male. The unemployed young black man in the inner city, the unemployed white man in Appalachia, when they lose their sense of provision, providing for others, the entire social structure around them begins to collapse. But we have so many laws against favoring males in employment that any kind of reinvigorating of that social element seems to be frustrated by our current legal structure. Do you agree or not?
Well, I don't know that it's frustrated by our current legal structure. I tend to think that there are a lot of cultural issues that aren't entirely explained by our current legal structure, but I'm sort of open to being convinced. I'm just sort of ignorant on some of the points that you're raising. So I'll sort of punt because of my ignorance on that one. But I agree with you that there is a very significant cultural problem that exists in a lot of these communities, and it is built around men. I mean, this is a classic story from my own life that I did not have, besides my grandfather, an active male role model in my life until I was, you know, 13 or 14 years old. And that obviously, the data is clear, that necessarily has its consequences. Now, I'm reminded, when you were asking that question, of a story that the Arthur Brooks of AEI tells about a man who had been incarcerated for a very long time, had recently gotten a job as a plumber, and got a call sometime, you know, 2 a.m, and somebody needed him to show up to fix an emergency leak. And the guy was excited, and his friends asked, "Why are you excited? You have to go work at 2 a.m. And he said, "This is the first time I've ever been needed, the first time I've ever been a necessary additive to the social fabric in some way or another. And this gets to the question of jobs and job training and whether we're preparing a lot of men and a lot of women, but I think this is a problem that's very acute among men for the jobs that are going to exist in the 21st century, because it's not just a good wage and provision. It's, of course, certainly part of that. But, you know, my grandpa's generation, they could come home from work and look their kids in the eye and said, I built something, I made something, I'm proud of what I did at work. And you have a whole generation, especially of men, who don't have that same pride, who don't have that same sense of being needed, who are not participating in dignified work. And I see that as a real failure of government policy, especially. Now, in a way that necessarily is worse for men than women, I don't know, as I just said. But look, you talk to employers, you talk to Chamber of Commerce folks, and they will tell you, look, we've got jobs. We had a 2.9% unemployment rate in Columbus. We're trying to hire people as we speak. The problem is you have a lot of people who have such a gigantic mismatch between what they're able to do and what we need them to do. And I think that's a real indictment of our education system. So this is one of those places where government policy done better could do a whole lot of good.
You mentioned religion and that a lot of people say they're religious, but they don't go to church. And of course, when you are religious but don't take your kids to church, then they lose that sense of religion,
sure.
I believe. Do you see anything that would reinvigorate people to begin to attend church again, or why they are not attending church and what can be done to correct that?
Yeah, well, what can be done to correct it? If we're talking about policy, I think this is one of the areas where policy is sort of uniquely unable to help the problem. Maybe not 100% unable, but I can't think of a good government intervention into this problem that makes a whole lot of sense or that would pass First Amendment muster, even if it did make a lot of sense. But I do think that, first of all, there's a huge awareness problem. And one of the really gratifying and hopeful things that I've heard in response to me publishing the book and conversations I've had with church leaders is they didn't realize that there was such a significant problem. Right, so these churches very often will go and do ministry work in Latin America or in Africa or in Asia, and they don't realize sometimes that the people who really need ministry just as much as people in far-flung corners of the world are actually folks who are right here in their back doors. I think a big driver of this decline of religious participation is the disappearance geographically of the community church in a lot of these places, right? So, you know, you can drive in Eastern Kentucky or West Virginia, even Southern Ohio, through certain neighborhoods, and the only sign of community church is an abandoned church building. That is a new thing in our society, and I think there's been a little bit of a, it's almost like there's been a church condensation in certain areas. You have really big church, typically in upper middle class and middle class areas. You don't have the church being that big of a community player in some of these lower middle class and working class neighborhoods. And so I do think that there's a geographic dispersion problem, but the only way I know how to fix it is to get church leaders and church congregants to recognize that there's an issue. And trust me, when they realize there's an issue, when they see the data, when they hear some of the stories and realize, oh wow, we actually don't have many lower income folks in our church, they start to do things to fix it. So I'm a little bit hopeful that when people learn that there's a problem, they start doing the things necessary to correct it.
So you've mentioned education a couple of times throughout this afternoon, and then you mention it frequently throughout your book. What is it that you think educators specifically, like teachers on an individual level, can do to identify children that are going through the problems or the struggles that you were able to overcome? And then also, I guess, aside from specific policy changes, what can administrators do without having to wait for, you know, the government to make decisions to allow them to address the problems?
Sure. Well, I think just keeping your eyes open and recognizing that when these kids struggle, it's not necessarily obvious from the outside. Maybe they're just not doing their work. Maybe they're acting out a little bit. Maybe they have a temper that's a bit unusual. Or maybe it's not unusual. Maybe they started the school year with that temper because they've been having these problems for a very long time. So I think sometimes it will hit you in the face, right? I, Right before I went to law school, I substitute taught for just a couple of months to try to earn some extra money. And I was sort of blown away that, you know, sometimes you'd have kids who'd show up and they wouldn't have a shirt on, right? So obviously that kid whose parents send them to school without a shirt, or usually it's that the kid sent himself to school without a shirt and it wasn't cold enough outside for him to remind himself, oh, I should put a shirt on. So that's an obvious signal, right? But I think that there are more subtle signals and ways to recognize that there are kids who are struggling. And there are, you know, look, I benefited a lot from teachers who took a special interest in me in one way or another. They didn't necessarily see that it was having a positive impact, but it certainly did over the course of my life. So I think that just knowing that it's there and trying actively to help these kids, to go the extra mile with some of these kids, even though you may not see the fruits of that labor, it's definitely going to have a big impact on a lot of kids.
excuse me. First, I'd like to echo the thanks of everyone for writing the book, and in particularly writing in a way that seems to have penetrated the fog of getting it across to some people who need to know what's going on. But what strikes me, and I don't know what we can do about, is in re-knitting the social fabric of churches, unions, cities, so many things, is that's polycentric, whereas a government, even if it's got a million agencies, is represented by the president. So over the last century of the social fabric fraying in all those institutions, you have an FDR, Johnson, someone promising all the freebies. And it seems to me that if you want to re-knit all of these other things as a substitute for government, people don't have the inspirational vision of some leader who says, I'm rebuilding the church, I'm rebuilding the union, I'm rebuilding the city park, one thing at a time. And I almost think that the president needs to have, you know, some partner walking around saying, I'll cover the other half of rebuilding this side while we tamp down the overgrown government. And that's what I'm wondering, is how does someone communicate this vision in a way that says, we've got a game plan to build these 72 different little platoons for you when there's the siren song of going back from Trump to Bernie Sanders of, don't worry, one-stop shopping, I'll give you all the free stuff here. And that's what it seems to me we need, and I don't know whether one preacher or visionary can tell all the pieces of the puzzle that we need in the way a government leader can.
Sure. Well, I certainly think that we need a lot of visionary community leaders and local leaders, and that unless you have those, you're not necessarily going to be able to do the things that have to happen. But I also am a little bit more optimistic that we have a lot of those visionary leaders. We do have people who are in these communities who are really concerned about solving these problems. I think in some ways they need maybe a little bit of help. Maybe they need the government to stop doing bad things that make it harder for them to do their job. Maybe they need the government to make it a little bit easier to do their job in one form or another. So I don't necessarily think that we have to pair or create these sort of community leaders to walk side by side with our political leaders, because I think a lot of them are there. But to your point about, you know, Johnson and FDR and Sanders and offering freebies, you know, I am not so pessimistic that people will necessarily choose the freebies so long as there's something else on the offering, right? And I think the failure of conservative politics and conservative messaging and conservative policy, all of the above, is that, you know, it's not like people look at the free stuff and say, that's really what we want to go after. That's really what we want to do. It's very often that's the only option. That's the only person. That's the only political party or political movement that's talking about the issues that are of special concern to these people. And I mean, look, sometimes to solve these issues, you are going to have to spend money. Sometimes to solve these issues, you will be able to spend much less money because we're already spending a lot of money and we're spending it stupidly. I don't think that we should necessarily take the frame that everywhere and always less government is necessarily the very best way to solve this problem. But I do think that look, Ronald Reagan, right? I'm reading this great book right now. It isn't out yet, but it's called The Working Class Republicans by Henry Olson, who's a very good political scientist. And his argument is that despite the way that Democrats especially, but even Republicans have sort of backward thought about Reagan, What did Reagan talk about? He didn't talk about the noble businessman all the time. It wasn't the free market system always in service of the great entrepreneur and all the wealth that that entrepreneur is going to create. It was that partially, but it was also there's nobility in just going to work on time and supporting your family. It was honoring the working class people in the party and talking about how his ideas were going to address the concerns of those working class folks. And of course, Reagan won 49 of 50 states. So I don't think it's always the case that people will choose the free stuff. I think it's the case that they will choose the free stuff when that's the only option on the menu.
We have time for one more question.
Aside from your hypothetical about the modernized union form, are there useful examples of mediating institutions out there that are not decaying? You know, something like maybe a hospice in the medical system that, you know, finds a niche and can be supported?
Well, I think that there are great examples of mediating institutions that aren't decaying, but it's all very often a regional story. So, right, I think if you look in Utah, for example, you have a lot of different mediating institutions, some religious and some not, that are incredibly successful and incredibly effective. You know, the public schools in Utah are really interesting. They, you know, the Mormon church in Utah is really interesting. And I think that's true if you look in Kansas, if you look in certain parts of Texas where you have a really robust evangelical Protestant church that's doing incredibly well, but maybe that's not the same thing that's happening if you look in southwestern Ohio. Or maybe in southwestern Ohio, that institution is very effective in the narrow community that it serves, but if it broadened its base a little bit, it would have a much more positive effect. So I actually think that there are a lot of really positive signs of mediating institutions doing good work. I just think in the communities that are most suffering, they're very often disappearing. And so the question isn't, how do we reverse the decline in these institutions? It's very often, how do we take the models that are working and transplant them to these other places? I guess that was the last question. So thank you guys. I really enjoyed that.
I'm just coming up here to say we are adjourned for 15 minutes. We'll come back at 1:45 and get the next panel going. And thank you to JD once more.